playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. One story dominated the airwaves this week as British Prime Minister Theresa May put her withdrawal agreement on leaving the European Union to the House of Commons on Tuesday.
The ayes to the right, 202. The noes to the left, 432.
A devastating defeat for Theresa May, a majority of 230 MPs against her, even worse than expected.
Going through the British papers this morning, the Daily Telegraph, a complete humiliation. The Guardian, May suffers historic defeat as Tories turn against her. The Sun, May's Brexit deal dead as a dodo. She's mocked up as a dodo. Brexstinct is its headline. The Daily Mail, fighting for her life. And the Independent, historic humiliation. It's wall-to-wall humiliation for Theresa May this morning.
Morning Ireland's Audrey Carville, live from outside Westminster. Her colleague, Louise Byrne, spoke to protesters from both sides of the Brexit divide.
The will of the people needs to be tested before we jump into something which is really difficult to recover from. And I think all this business about social unrest, etc., is a load of nonsense. I'm a new Irish citizen. When they announced there was going to be a referendum, I thought, I don't want to be British anymore, I'm going to be Irish, instead. We're going to leave on no deal. That's what should happen. No deal. Best way forward. The EU on March the 30th will come crawling back to us for a deal. You have to leave with no deal. Otherwise, you could see civil unrest. We don't want to see that. I want to see my vote respected.
Brexit's on fire. Brexit's on fire.
We're standing here on the green in the shadow of Westminster. The vote has just been happened and there are two sides screaming and shouting at each other. Are you worried about the social fabric of Britain in all of this?
I think we've got to recognise the problems that Brexit's exposed. Brexit itself was never going to solve those problems. No matter what happened next, those problems have been exposed now and we need to start healing. It is going to be difficult to make sure we don't inflame that problem.
Stop Brexit! Save Britain!
So what I've got is a blue wig and a blue beret. Scratch an Englishman and you'll still find someone who thinks that Ireland belongs to the UK. We know we need to be a much more modern nation and we need to have a proper adult relationship with our neighbours.
People voted for Brexit. Not half in, not half out, a Brexit.
And what does that mean for the border in Ireland?
Difficult. It is difficult. But, you know,
what will be, will be.
What will be, will be. Exactly that, you know.
Singing we've got a bird like a year. Singing we've got a bird like a year. We've got a bird like a year.
Louise Byrne reporting. Well, Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn took the opportunity to table a motion of no confidence. Theresa May survived by just 19 votes, saved by the DUP.
I believe it is my duty to deliver on the British people's instruction to leave the European Union, and I intend to do so. So now MPs have made clear what they don't want, we must all work constructively together to set out what Parliament does want. That's why I'm inviting MPs from all parties to come together to find a way forward, one that both delivers on the referendum and can command the support of Parliament. This is now the time to put self-interest aside.
So much for cross-party talks. Jeremy Corbyn described the move as a stunt and refused to take part in these discussions until a no-deal Brexit was taken off the table. So it was a case of keep calm and carry on amid the chaos. But carry on about what? With what? 69 days to go to the Brexit deadline on March 29th. And who can say what the British Parliament actually wants? We'll have to wait until next Monday when Brexit Plan B will be revealed.
At the end of what's certainly been a dramatic but perhaps not terribly decisive week in relation to Brexit at Westminster, where are we now? What's going to happen over the next number of days and weeks?
Well, look what happened this week. After all the travelling and all the appeals and all the statements she made, Theresa May lost. Jeremy Corbyn, after all the threatening that he was going to call an election, that he had this, you know, weapon in his pocket and he was going to spring it, he did and he lost. And the main winners this week, the people who got what they wanted, extraordinary really, are the DUP. 10 members, 650 member chamber. They were against the deal. They led the opposition within the Tory organisation to it, and they got what they wanted. But now, Brian, now comes the hard part. They're at the very centre of power. Look at the pictures last night. Who was in the Cabinet Office? Everybody else. Who was in Downing Street? The DUP. And you're quite right. Listen to the language that came out. Not a softening of position, but maybe a realism creeping in there. Nigel Dodds coming out of Downing Street yesterday, what did he talk about? He talked about a satisfactory solution to the backstop issue. That's new language, and I think that shows new pragmatism, or people who realise they've got where they want it. They're in the centre of power, but now they have to start exercising it. They can't just be blockers.
RTÉ's Northern editor Tommy Gorman with Brian Dobson. Well, the entire shambles was also discussed on The Gathering by Sinn Féin's Matt Carthy, Fine Gael's Kate O'Connell, Olivia Buckley of the Irish Tax Institute, and by political correspondent with Independent News and Media, John Downing.
Probably two definitive things. One, I think we were definitely looking at an extension, though that's very problematic. Matt Carthy here to my right. Big questions about how that enmeshes with the European Parliament elections. The second thing is there may be, if you're trying to take some kind of positive out of all of this, the British political leaders may finally be starting to have the debate they should have had at least 2 years ago.
What about our level of preparedness? We heard in the clip there the Taoiseach saying it's no longer about contingency, it's planning that has to go ahead. But is Paddy being told the full story, to borrow that phrase from his predecessor, Enda Kenny, about what is and isn't happening or what will or won't happen in the event of a hard Brexit? Was that exchange that one of your colleagues recorded?
Yes.
With
yes.
Effectively Simon Coveney saying to Shane Ross.
Yeah. Philip Ryan asked the perfect question, which crystallised the whole thing. A lorry coming from Scotland, going through the six counties, coming into this jurisdiction, what happens? Will there be checks? Shane Ross actually quite innocently, and I think maybe through not doing his homework and paying enough attention in class, did give the right answer.
Truthfully, it is a truthful
answer, yeah.
And if there were a hard Brexit, but we're not expecting it.
Simon shushed him, says you can't be saying that,
yeah,
because we don't want to be the people seen to be bringing back a hard border in Ireland.
But within the withdrawal agreement, which the British government signed up to, the legally binding backstop, that there will be no hard border. This is the binding backstop
that was voted down by 230 votes. Yeah. Matt Carthy.
By the British, but we're part of a united bloc. There's chaos over there. We're sticking firm to our position, and I'd imagine there's consensus on the island of Ireland that nobody wants a return to a hard border.
From the Today Show yesterday, the Master of the High Court, Edmund Honohan, hit the headlines recently. He smashed three window panes in a courtroom in the forecourts because he said the bad ventilation was making him sick and he was picking up colds and flu.
I would say sometimes I've had to work in fairly stuffy studios, but I think if I broke a window here in RTÉ, I might quickly be shown the door. How did you get away with breaking not one, but was it three windows in your courtroom?
Oh, well, these are small panels in an area above the back door. I have to give you a context here, John. I actually have a statutory obligation to ensure that hearings in my court are fair. Now, every time I finish my list at 4 o'clock, my room is sealed. All the stale air of the day is left in that room until I walk in again at 10:30 the following morning with coughs and sneezes from everybody. And we have lay litigants and we have practitioners there sweating it out in the dank atmosphere, the fog, as I call it. I'll give you an example of a case. Last Friday, I had a lady in and she was trying to appeal a 2012 possession order. And the bank was objecting to her reading out her own affidavit. Now, you can imagine in a full courtroom how tense this prospect is for her. She asked for her son to read the affidavit out, and the bank objected. Now, this is the sort of area where it's impossible to create the impression to a lady like that that she's getting a fair hearing. And I'm of the view that it's an obligation on me to ensure that insofar as it's possible for me to do so, I should do so. So, in fact, what I did was I opened up a vent at the back of the room in order to create a through flow of air, an extraction of the stale air, if you like. And I believe that was justified.
But how long have you had this difficulty, Edmund Honohan, in your courtroom?
Oh, at least 10 years. Obviously, most time of the year it's not too bad, but when the heating is on and the windows are closed because it's cold outside, then you have a situation where the temperature and everybody wearing gowns and so forth, the temperature rises, the stale air is stale, the ventilation system is not working, and if you do open the one window, which is beside me at the bench, you then catch a cross flow of cold air, which causes me anyway to get colds and flu. And this is not a healthy environment for anybody to work in, at least, not least for the purposes of doing justice.
So early last month, Edmund Honohan brought in a hammer from home and went about breaking three small panels in a glazed window between his courtroom and a corridor running alongside it.
How I went about it is quite simple. The only way to get rid of a window is to break it. So I managed to find myself a hammer and broke it. So I left a message on it, actually, to say, do not re-glaze. But, of course, that was ignored.
This was premeditated, obviously.
Oh, yes, yes.
I mean, had you made phone calls to anybody asking, look, will you, for heaven's sake, will you come down, will you stand or sit in my courtroom for even half an hour to experience what I and the people who work with me have to endure and the clients, the lay litigants?
Everybody knows. You can ask any practitioner in the law library what the situation's like in the master's room.
What about the OPW?
I don't know. I'm not a bureaucrat. I don't deal with bureaucrats. I'm not an employee of the court service. I expect the room to be serviceable.
From Today with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. Farmers around the country are up in arms this week following the publication of a landmark study by the Lancet Medical Journal, which claimed that we need to limit our meat consumption to one burger a week or a steak a month and reduce our dairy intake if we want to save the planet. 37 scientific experts from 16 countries concluded that our food system is faulty and civilization is in crisis. Well, Drive Time reporter John Cook visited the mart in Ennis in County Clare to gauge the temperature.
800. Well, I believe in eating meat. Like, I might eat it good for you anyway. So
what are you going to have for the dinner here at the mart?
A steak.
Steak for yourself. What do you think about all these reports? Is it a bad time for beef farmers?
Oh, yeah, of course it is, with Brexit, and it's obviously very bad publicity, with the links to climate change. And I think rural Ireland is totally based on agriculture, like, and it's especially exports. And you're not going to be able to milk cows in the west of Ireland with some of the land as well. So, I mean, beef production, livestock production is probably the only viable options.
What's that?
He's spreading out these rumours to take away what he should be doing himself with Brexit. He's so only to throw people off from their own mistake.
Farmers are working hard. They want meat. They want meat.
You couldn't survive without meat, so?
No. We used to eat meat all our life. How are we going to put back now?
We used to eat bacon and cabbage 6 days a week.
Bacon and cabbage?
Yeah, 6 days a week. And we might have beef for Sunday. And they lived up to 90 years of age.
You don't think we'll be changing our habits that much, though?
No.
All these guys have soft jobs. They're lying down. They have no exercise. The farmer is working.
So people who don't you think people don't eat meat are soft? Yeah. They're not hard workers.
But they're not hard workers because they're sitting down with soft, big jobs, soft jobs. All OTDs are above and they're getting a big salary. They're getting 100,000 more in expenses. How is that any man going to live in a poor, bad land around this side of the world?
All these fads going on around it.
It's just a fad.
One time they were telling you not to eat butter. Now it's good for you. Now I heard fat meat, pork, I think. Fat pork is actually good for you now.
And now these latest reports, though, tell us cut down on meat by 90%, yeah. Down to half a rasher a day maybe is as much as we should be allowed.
I'll go away.
Just a fad diet, you think?
That's about it.
Well, over on Liveline, independent TD for Kerry, Michael Healy-Ray, dismissed the Lancet findings as rubbish. He spoke with Philip Boucher-Hayes.
Michael Healy-Ray, thank you very much for hanging on there. Are you hearing anything that's persuading you to change your mind?
Well, to be honest with you, Philip, unlike yourself, I listen to all sides of every debate. And I listen to it in a reasonable and a thoughtful way. That's why I've said at the very beginning, everyone on all sides of this argument, I respect their opinions, but I don't have to agree with a report that has been brought out. You seem to welcome it with open arms and propagate it as the new gospel. That's your entitlement as the presenter of the show. If you want to be biased and favour it in one side of the argument, that's your entitlement.
Okay, if there's one my thing I'm going to try and persuade you of here, Michael Healy-Ray, just hang on for one second.
I thought you'd allow me to finish, Philip, but if you won't,
In fairness to you, Michael, I will allow you to finish if you'll allow me to then debate something backwards and forwards with you for a second. Go on.
Well, it's your show. Continue, because you can cut me off if you like.
No, I wouldn't dream of it, Michael. You're the elected representative of Kerry. I would never disrespect the people of Kerry in that way. Please.
Well, you did already because you insulted me at the very beginning of the show. That was you were just losing the run of yourself.
No, look, I lose the run of myself very frequently. I didn't on that occasion.
Well, you should calm down a small bit when you're the presenter of a show. There is nothing wrong with people eating meat. And for people to come out today with a report saying that we should cut back on our meat consumption by 90% and trying to encourage people to stop drinking milk and using dairy products, I think that's outrageous. I thought it was outrageous.
But which is more outrageous, Michael, that we should continue farming or that people should advise this? Because, you know, the ice caps are melting, coastal communities are being threatened, the permafrost is melting, releasing bacteria that we have no way of dealing with. You know, when you have to spend more on flood defences in your constituency than you're able to spend on roads and schools, will it still be outrageous then?
Philip, for God's sake, just think about what you're saying. You're telling people so that if we don't all stop eating meat, the world is going to end as we know it. I think that is a load of absolute rubbish. The world has continued up until now with people eating what they wanted to eat. And this seems to be a new fad at the moment.
From Liveline with Philip Boucher-Hayes on Thursday. Well, last September, news that a massive sinkhole had appeared in the GAA pitch in Maharaclune in County Monaghan made headlines. 4 months later, some local residents are still out of their homes and are looking for answers to the situation caused by the effects of gypsum mining in the area. Evelyn O'Rourke visited Maharaclune to speak to residents, among them Angela and Damien Martin.
I've so many different emotions. The whole parish has just been devastated. Our parish is 15 miles long and 3 miles wide. And there's a big, big chunk in the middle of it of a few miles that is just going to sink into one big lake. That's all we can see. No.
Our lives just fell apart. I went to Carrickmacross that morning to a computer course. I heard the news in Carrickmacross. I rang Damien and I said, is that true? And he said, it's true. 50 yards across the road from us.
When you left the house that morning, everything was normal.
Everything was normal.
And you came home to this chaos.
It's absolute chaos, Evelyn. It's the first thought when we wake up in the morning, is the last thought at night, is just the fear of the unknown.
The word evacuate on its own was just, didn't even want to hear it. The realisation was that nobody knew where this sinkage was going to stop. We moved out on the advice of the company. They're paying the rent, yeah. Yeah, we may be moving back out in March, I don't know. We have to get more reassurances though.
Evelyn O'Rourke reporting from Maharaclune in County Monaghan. Well, Sean O'Rourke asked the managing director of the mining company, Giprock Ireland, what exactly caused the sinkholes to appear.
First of all, can I start really by really offering my apologies again to the whole community. We do recognise that this has been, a fairly traumatic event for everyone up there. And, we have been members of that community for 80 years and we intend to be members for, another 80 years if we can.
I suppose the question arises, if it's not safe or if they feel it's not safe for them to return, will you buy new homes or supply new homes for them?
We will certainly discuss all options with the residents to look at this issue. There's a short-term issue that we have to deal with, and I suppose that's what we're doing at the moment, and that's why we're assisting these residents with temporary accommodation, and we will look at all options as we look at longer-term solutions.
From Today with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. Well, it's hard to believe, but it's a year since rock star Dolores O'Riordan was found dead in a London hotel room. And on her first anniversary, which fell on Tuesday, all over the world, her fans remembered her. And RTE2FM rebroadcast an interview Dolores did with another superstar, the late Gerry Ryan, back in 2002, when the Cranberries came in for a recording session.
David Bowie says all the best music was written when he was really unhappy. And he was on drugs and when he was demented and he didn't see his family and people were trying to shoot him. Do you believe that you have to be really unhappy to write good music?
Not really, but I think there's a lot more passion when you are unhappy, you know what I mean? Because you're so messed up. And I think a lot of people relate to that being messed up or confused or lost or whatever, as opposed to being happy. It's something you take for granted, you know? The problem with a lot of really sad songs is that it's really hard to perform them live, you know? I mean, there's certain songs I will not play live. Like, no need to argue, I haven't done that for about 8 years or something. Just kind of gave it up. That was then and this is now. And, sometimes if you sang the song, it would bring back the memory, so you stop doing it, you know.
Do you know, people like snapshots into your life that they'd like to hear you argue again, I think, sometime.
Yeah.
Okay, what's next?
What you want to do next? Ode to my family?
Ode, yeah.
Right. So this is like
democratic.
And this this is like Oats My Family was written in the good old days. It was probably about 1992. Well,
how many phases are there? There's the bad old days, the half bad, there's all the almost good. I can't remember it.
No, there's a pattern where it starts. Okay. And you know, we got really famous and it was great for a while, and then it got out of hand, and then we got completely messed up, and then we all ended up like basket cases, and then we took a break and we got better, and now it's kind of like we're back where it was when we began.
The late Dolores O'Riordan in conversation with the late Gerry Ryan 17 years ago on 2FM, both sorely missed. Well, to celebrate Dolores' legacy, her bandmates in the Cranberries have released a new song with Dolores on vocals. It's called All Over Now. The Cranberries' new single, All Over Now, which Áine Lawler played on the News at One on Tuesday. Drive Time reporter John Cook was in the parish of Drumkeen in County Limerick on Wednesday for the closure of the local post office. It was the 100th rural branch to close since Unpost announced consolidation of its network 4 months ago, and 50 more will go by the end of January.
Tony, I don't know how you describe this event. Is it a bit like a wake or a party? I'm not sure.
Well, we're the wake first and we're the party tonight. All the talk today is about Brexit, but this is all Brexit. Closing of our local post office, you know, just here all our lives, you know. There was always service with a smile here with Mary, you know, and it was much a social occasion coming to the post office as a business event or whatever.
And you said this is your Brexit. How does it affect this local community or economy to not have a post office? Because some would say offices like this, a small little one in a thatched cottage, they're a thing of the past.
They're a thing of the past, yeah. We'll never again see the light, you know. But I suppose the younger generation don't mind. They seem to get on with flashcards and tap and go and this kind of thing. But the older generation, like myself, you like to be the cash in your pocket. And you come here to Mary and you've got your cash out of the post office. You know?
Will so, it change the community of Drumkeen? So?
Yeah, we won't meet as often because, as you know, we haven't as many people going to mess anymore and creameries are gone and there don't seem to be much else left now, you know. And we can't go to the pub anymore because we can't drive home. So I don't know what we're going to do. We'll be isolated at home in our own homes. No one's going to stand up for us now. This is all over. The younger population will dictate what happens in rural Ireland. They don't seem to be worried about it.
John also spoke with postmistress Mary McKenna.
You're crying today, Mary.
I am very sad over it. This is the only thing I know since I was 19 years of age. So I just feel so sad about this. When they asked me to take the voluntary redundancy, I asked them, could I stay here for another 5 years and get my redundancy? And they said no. I asked them, could I stay for 3 years? And they said no. They wanted me to go on the 31st of October and I begged them to leave me on for Christmas. So they did.
Have you been stamping some of the post here with last postmark?
I have. And it's awful. It's so sad. It's so sad. You know, people are doing deposits in their books to have to pay to show to their grandchildren. That I did my last transaction in Drumkeen Post Office in 2019, and the 16th of January was the day that it closed. I am so sad about it.
It's a real part of history, I can tell, in this community. Times have changed, though. What's the future for rural communities after these post office closures, do you think?
Look at the postmaster's going and the postman going. The government don't care anything about rural Ireland.
You feel that way?
I do, yes. If they want, they could keep post houses open.
John Cook reporting for Wednesday's Drive Time. Best-selling author Carla Nore was Ray Darcy's guest on Tuesday. His new book, Bolder, Making the Most of Our Longer Lives, is a wake-up call for people to become less ageist and to stop worrying about the process of ageing. As he put it, to get rid of that yoke of age around our neck that so often defines us.
We are beginning to enter a golden age of aging. You know, this is a time not only for longer lives.
Yeah.
I think so. I think that in many ways this is the best, well, it is clearly the best time to be growing older ever in human history. But the catch here is that rather than cracking open the champagne to celebrate this demographic bounty spreading out before us, we cling to the old ageist tropes, the chamber of horrors narrative about growing older, that from 35, it's a downhill slither and slide towards dementia, decrepitude, depression, incontinence, all the things that people associate.
You make
with
a very interesting
older.
Observation in the book that when a person over the age of 60 forgets where they left their hat or their phone or their keys, it's a senior moment. When somebody in their 20s does it, nobody bats an eyelid.
Yeah, I mean, I tell you, I know from my own experience that I have been mislaying my keys since I was a teenager. But it was only really when I hit 40 that I started using against my own self the idea of a senior moment. I'm not mislaying my keys any more frequently than I did when I was 21, now that I'm 51. But of course, I have also, or had anyway, I've sloughed it off now, but I had also swallowed that dreadful ageist idea that somehow it's all bad, right?
Yes.
That everything about growing older is bad. And it's woven into our vernacular. You use that expression, senior moment, which just trips off the tongue. We laugh, we're poking fun at each other, at ourselves. It seems all very lighthearted. But every time we use a phrase like that, it reinforces that toxic idea that growing older is to become a worse version of yourself every day after whatever it is. You know, some people say 30, 35, 40 or whatever. But the expressions are all there. We talk about being finished at 40, right?
Yes.
Or feeling your age means
yes.
feeling feeble, yeah. weak, inferior, all that stuff. So it's all kind of in there.
The depiction of old people, you know, in media can be stereotypical. And it's all fun and it can be fun. But there is a serious side to this in that if we believe this to be true, it can actually affect us in a real way. It's nearly like a placebo effect.
Well, this is the thing I found almost most alarming in the research that I uncovered, is that an unfavorable view of aging becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So the one thing is very clear from all of the research and all of the science, that if you believe that growing older is going to suck, it is going to suck, right?
Carla Nore with Ray Darcy on Tuesday. A new documentary series on T.G. Cahir on Wednesday nights has been getting a lot of attention. It's called On Balla, or The Wall, and it explores some of the world's most iconic walls and borders and the stories behind them. The presenter, Sheila Nikonaney, spoke with Ryan Tuberty on Tuesday, and they talked about the Berlin Wall, the Korean Demilitarized Zone, what's called the Israeli-Palestine Separation Barrier, and of course the US-Mexico border, the controversial wall which was a key factor in Donald Trump's presidential election.
I didn't know until your programme, because I was so ill-informed, that there's a massive wall on the Mexico border already. I was shocked to see the size and the scope of it.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, it doesn't cover the whole border.
No,
so the border
that.
Between the US and Mexico is 2,000 miles, and,
yeah.
you know, that would be an enormous wall to build. But there are certainly places where there's a wall. So Tijuana and San Diego are on opposite sides of the border on the west coast. And that wall, at that point, goes right into the sea. It goes 300 metres into the Pacific Ocean, which is really bizarre to look at. You're on the beach, in the sand, people are swimming or walking up and down, and there's a fence, a huge metal fence going right into the water. If you go to the other side of Tijuana, the eastern side, that wall is about 14 miles, as far as I remember, and the wall just stops. Mm. Like, literally, you can walk, which I did, to the end of it, and you stand there, and you go, okay, so if I take a step this way, I'm now in the US, and if I take a step back, I'm back in Mexico. And that is where people cross. So places like that, they go into the desert and they cross at night, which is incredibly dangerous. And, you know, we went into the desert in Arizona. We met some of the people who were working voluntarily to supply water to those who cross the desert at night. They call themselves Humane Borders, and they're mainly retired people who come from around the US because they believe that humans are humans at the end of the day. And if they're making this journey, they shouldn't die of thirst. At the very least, that's what we can do for them, they say. That was a very distressing visit for me, I have to say.
I can imagine. I could see you were distressed in the programme because you found the water beakers and items of clothing that were still essentially warm from being warm. But these people are on the run. They're like, kind of, it's like the Hunger Games, isn't it?
They're on the run. There are dogs in the desert who are released to find them. There are triggers so that they're setting off so that border control can find them. They're young. They're scared. They've already come past possibly the drug cartels and the coyotes, and they've had to negotiate that.
And Sheila also told Ryan about some of the true believers she met along the way, among them Bob, the vigilante.
God, Bob. I mean, part of me is really scared of somebody like Bob. So he's in his 70s and he's got all these guns and he's wearing 20 kgs of ammo and bulletproof vests and all the rest of it, and his land borders Mexico and he patrols it and he's looking for immigrants. So part of me is scared of him and part of me feels really sorry for him, because he's built his own wall alongside the actual wall that exists there. And he says America's being invaded and it's his duty as an American to protect his country. And I just look at that wall in his brain and I think, you know, for all of these countries, all of these places we visited, Ryan, people are people. Whether you're Mexican or American, whether you're Palestinian or Israeli, whether you're from North or South Korea, you know, at the end of the day, people want a degree of peace. They want to live safely. They want to live happily and their kids to be okay. And there's this huge divide when you build a wall. You push the other people and their experience to the other side of the wall so that you don't have to look at it. I think that's what's really dangerous.
Documentary maker Sheila Nicanaini has heard on The Ryan Tuberty Show. Over on Liveline on Thursday, Philip Boucher-Hayes was dealing with haunted telephones.
Imagine your phone ringing off the hook all day long. Literally every 2 to 3 minutes. Every time the caller says, "Just missed a call from you." Except you haven't called anyone. Sandra's phone, it would seem, is haunted. She gets a call every 2 or 3 minutes at the moment, and all the callers believe that she has called them. She hasn't, though. So her phone is calling numbers at random, apparently non-stop, and they're all ringing her back. But Eyre says that there isn't a fault on her line.
It started about 7 o'clock on Saturday evening, and I answered a good few of them, and then I began to kind of say, well, what's going on here? So I rang Eyre Saturday evening, and I've told them what was happening, and they were very puzzled. They've never heard of this before. And they said to me, right, we'll check your line. And they asked me to disconnect my phone. They rang me back on my mobile. They said, disconnect your broadband and your phone and we'll check it out. And they came back and they said, yeah, there's some fault. We'll have somebody out within 3 working days, so by next Wednesday. But this was happening all over the weekend. And I rang on Monday and I said, look, is there any chance you can mark this as urgent? And the gentleman said, look, we'll have to go through everything again. We'll check your phones again. And he checked it and he said, we can't find a fault.
Oh, so the fault that they had detected on Saturday wasn't there?
No.
But your phone is still ringing once every 10 minutes?
Yes. So they said there's nothing they can do. They're puzzled. I was on for about an hour and a half on Monday, and they were putting me on hold and talking to the technicians and coming back and asking me different questions and all sorts. And they said, look, we can't find anything, so there will be nobody out to you.
Well, like Sandra, Mary also had a problem with her phone.
It happens once a month, random day, and then the calls come in every half an hour. So I could have up to 17.
And then it won't happen for 3 or 4 weeks.
And then it doesn't happen for 3 or 4 weeks again. So it's just odd, strange, and, you know, because I'm not under, you know, constant barrage of them, I kind of just go away and ignore it. But I have set it to aircom, but I didn't get anywhere. I mean, they just said, maybe change your handset.
Were they kidding? Maybe change your handset.
Change my handset, yeah.
From Liveline on Thursday. Over on Countrywide, Damien O'Reilly visited the farm owned by Michael Doran, just outside Rosslare in County Wexford, where illegal dumping was taking place.
As I walk through it, I can see black bags of household waste. I can see clothes, bags of underwear, bras, shoes, boots. children's toys. We even have a kettle, an old television, an iron. And as I walk across into the field through the gap, I see another pile of mattresses, dirty bedclothes, old carpets, a suitcase, a part of a computer, empty bottles and cans, even some Christmas decorations. And these have been dumped here on this farm over the last couple of weeks. Michael, this is a mixed enterprise here of grassland and tillage. Thankfully, there are no farm animals out at this time of the year. When did you come across this scene of horror on your farm?
The first time was about 10 days before Christmas. I got a phone call from a person who walks dogs here to say that there was a good mattresses and household contents dumped. There was a lock on the gate. The first time they found the key and they opened the lock because it's a working farm, it's an out farm, but it's tillage, so the contractor needs a key to get in. And then the second time was, we think, last Sunday night, and I got a phone call again to say that an awful lot more contents had been dumped.
Now, whoever did this, they went to an awful lot of trouble to get the rubbish from their house to here.
Yes, it's like that someone was actually moving out of a house or clearing out all the contents of the house. It's just disgusting.
Oh,
like, you know, computer, television, suitcases.
This didn't come out of the boot of a car. This came out of the back of a van or a trailer, probably two or three runs to get all of this stuff here.
Definitely. It had to be a trailer. I don't think it would even fit in the back of a van, no matter even a high-S. Like, I don't think we'd be able to hold the amount of stuff that's in it. Like,
you've left this as you found it.
I was so disgusted when I found it the first time. I reported it to the guards straight away. They said that when I didn't have CCTV, there was very little that they could do. They put me in touch with the environmental section in the Wexford County Council. They looked at it and said that because it was on private property, down a lane, accessed through a gate, that it wasn't their responsibility and that there was nothing they could do for me.
Farmer Michael Doran there with Damien O'Reilly, heard on Countrywide. One of the country's most successful CEOs, Gary McGann, was Richard Curran's guest on The Business, an interview he recorded at the recent Pendulum Summit in Dublin.
When it comes to working with people, working for people, you have worked with a lot of very interesting names over the years. We're talking about Smurfit. Michael Smurfit, what was he like to work for?
Unique.
Is that a neutral term?
No, not at all, not at all. Michael was probably one of the most unusual men I've ever met. Michael fought with you, I think, almost for the sake of fighting. And if you didn't fight back, he had no respect for you. If you did fight back, you ended up with great results. He believed everything was possible. He saw no reason why we shouldn't be the world leaders in paper-based packaging, which we eventually became. He saw no reason why he couldn't take over the biggest companies in the business. He saw no reason why he should pay higher prices for his debt than anybody else, and ideally lower. So he all the time pushed people to the limits. But he had two great, great pieces of makeup. He never looked back. If we missed out on something, if we lost a deal, if something went wrong, we'd have a good screaming match, but then it was over. Then we'd be back on level keel.
And when you say a screaming match, you're talking about a screaming match.
Oh, we would have had good screaming matches, yeah. Michael didn't bottle it up. Michael got it out on the table and felt all the better for it. And sometimes we did too, but very seldom. But he was an inspirational leader. And he has this mantra that says, if it isn't criminal and it isn't terminal, it isn't a problem. And you know, he's right.
Gary McGann with Richard Curran on The Business. But I leave you now with a song from Rosie Carney and Lisa Hannigan, which I heard on The South Wind Blows. Gramaga vasur goluder, tasulam garwanchev saltasaglar, ags gamejev lamtak anamakena, an tachtan johogin, gijishin, gijishab slan. She sings.